Hello, welcome to another episode of The High Ground, powered by Premier Companies. Jeff, how are you doing this morning?
I'm wonderful, Sal. Yourself?
I'm just wonderful also. We've got a special guest in the podcast room with us this morning.
Who you got?
Randy Meddy. But before we introduce Randy, we got to start with the question of the day, Randy.
Uh-oh.
And this is a hard one.
Okay.
Kind of weird. It's like a science fiction one. If you had a time machine, Randy, would you go back in time or into the future, and for what purpose?
That's a good question, Sal.
Yep.
Boy, actually, I think I'd go back in time, and I'd probably go back to about 1804.
That's pretty specific.
That's really specific, and I'd probably be on the banks of the Mississippi River in St. Louis. If you think back about what that time is, if you look back, that's where Lewis and Clark left on their expedition to go out and really look at the and get the overall layout of the Louisiana Purchase. And as I think about that, if I was to tag along on that expedition and to see what the landscape looked like, the unbroken prairies out across that geography, what it looked like then, the river systems, all that type of stuff, and what it looks like today, I think that'd be very intriguing to see the unbroken prairie lands and where they're at today and how that has transpired and what kind of living conditions and how those individuals, as time progressed, how challenging life was for them at that point in time and what made life enjoyable for them and what it looks like today. And it'd be totally, totally different. But just to see the progress from 1804, so 220 years ago, right?
Yeah.
How much that has progressed and how much has changed over that time. On the flip side, if I was to go into the future, what would it look like 200 years from now? Is that going to be scary? I have no idea what it looks like. It'd be interesting to see, but I'd be more apt to go back into the past.
Yeah, especially that those times when you have no idea. There's no cameras or anything.
That's right.
And it was just wilderness.
Right.
I mean, those are the mountain men.
That's right. And then dealing with the local natives in those geographies as well, right? They went into, Lewis and Clark went into those areas, and they were foreigners. And it's no different than us walking onto a grower's farm sometime or dealing with a new supplier, whatever that may be. They're foreigners to us a lot of times, right? So how do you bridge that gap from a communication standpoint and understanding who they are, what they're about, what their needs are, things like that? That would have to be a huge barrier for them as they's going into those specific regions and trying to communicate with the local populace. So it'd be interesting to see how they navigated through that, how they documented all their information that they were gathering, how they reported that back to Thomas Jefferson, because he was the one that sent them on that expedition. It'd be really interesting to see how that all happened. It was all on pencil and paper, right? It's not on email. It's not on text messages, none of that, no cameras or anything. So it'd been interesting to see.
All right. Well, top that, Jeff.
I don't know. I just got a picture of Randy wearing full buckskins, carrying a flintlock rifle and walking onto a guy's farm. So I like to sell you seed.
Right. Here you are.
I tell you.
Yeah. You know, I think I would do the same thing. I'd go back in time. I really like your answer, and that would be interesting, but I think I would probably not go back quite as far in time, but I think it'd be cool to go back to when your great grandparents were younger, you know, to go back and see what the family farm looked like back then, you know, what kind of decisions they were making. I'd probably tell them, it's like, you need to buy more acres now. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Don't care. It's $3 an acre. Doesn't matter.
Yeah. Right. It's like, so when, you know, when I go back to the future or go back to the current time and I'm growing up, then I'd have a bigger farm, you know, that type of thing. So, you know, that's what I would do. So interesting.
Well, those are both good. And I would go back also, just not as far. I would go back. My grandfather on my mom's side was kind of the last of the old timers. And then my dad's dad was, he was the Italian immigrant. He was just immigrated from Italy. But I would go back just that far because there was so much knowledge and things that I never knew that I was missing out on when I was a kid. I mean, we did everything. We made, ground our own cornmeal. We, you know, grandma made her own soap. I mean, it wasn't quite like the Beverly Hillbillies, but it was close enough.
Right.
I mean, we did, butchered all of our own animals and all that. And just the things that was in, he knew that just never got passed on, you know, and some of that, just that knowledge and yeah, you probably Google it now, but It was just, we did so much by ourselves.
Right.
Yeah, yeah,
right.
They did all that without Google.
Without Google. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And hand milked a cow every day and had milk. I never had store-bought milk until I went to kindergarten. I couldn't drink it.
So it was a little thin, wasn't it?
It was a little thin, yeah. I was like, wah. Well, that was interesting. Well, Randy, thank you for that. That's good.
You bet.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, kind of introductions and your career path and how you got to where you're at today?
Sure. Yeah. So Randy Meddy, worked for Winfield United as a seed product manager. And I'll dive into that here in a little bit, what that kind of entails. But born and raised in Effingham, Illinois. So South Central Illinois is where I was born and raised. Still live there. And really my career path, Sal, and Jeff, going up through high school, I mean, we're always starting to think, okay, what's my career path going to look like? What kind of job do I want? What industry do I want to be in? I want to be in sales of some sort. What that looked like, I really didn't know, but it was not going to be agriculture. Okay.
And but you knew you was going to be in sales.
I knew I was going to be in sales of some sort. That's what I wanted to do. Huh. Yeah. And the reason I didn't want to be in agriculture at that time was because, as most of us, when we're growing up, and especially when we turn 16, 17, 18, get a little bit of freedom, flexibility, and have the ability to go out on our own a little bit more. I grew up on a small family farm, and it was always weekends and nights because my dad had a job in town as well. And of course, that's when everything had to get done. And that did not align with my timeline at that point in time in my life. So I'm like, I do not want to be in agriculture. Ironically, through college and through high school, I worked at a local retailer at the hardware store. And that's how I made ends meet at that point in time. And the general manager at that time, a guy by the name of Dennis Monovan, I got to know him pretty well while I was working there. And once I graduated college with a degree in marketing, I went to work for a different company outside of ag retail. And he told me, he said, Randy said, if you ever want to come back, he said, we'll have a position for you. And I said, well, Dennis, I'd never worked in ag. I said, I've been around it, but never have worked in it. He said, that's fine. He said, we can teach you what you need to know.
So this was a hardware store?
This was a hardware store associated with the retailer. Okay. That's correct. Yes. And so the job that I had right out of college, I didn't really like that. Like most college graduates, you're not going to settle on your first job, right?
So not our college graduates, right, Jeff?
This right. Those that go into ag and the ag retail site, they stay there. Right?
Ours will stay.
They stay there. But so anyway, I came back to him and I said, Dennis, I said, I'd be interested if there's an opportunity. And there was. Okay. And so I started out in the ag retail side, just driving a floater, spreading fertilizer, doing a little bit of spray and things like that, doing some crop scouting, and then worked into sales after a year. And selling crop inputs, so fertilizer, chemicals, seed, things like that. So did that for about three or four years. And then they brought on the seed business. They started the seed business back in 96 is what it was. And in 97 or so, I started just selling seed specifically and was a seed specialist covering three locations within that retail organization and really liked the seed piece of it. So did that for several years and then finished up at that ag retailer as the seed department manager. And did that for a couple of years. And then after 18 years with that retail retailer, I went ahead and thought, well, there might be a time or opportunity to do something a little bit different, and had the opportunity to come on to Winfield at that point in time back in 2012 and started there with Winfield as a master agronomy advisor. So just calling on larger growers on behalf of the local retailer, trying to bring that business into them, and did that for a couple of years and then transitioned into a seed manager for the local regions and covered several co-ops then. And then about 3.5 years ago, had the opportunity to come on as a seed product manager. So I'm one of seven across the United States that help pick and choose corn and soybean hybrids and varieties to go into the cropland bag and build the overall portfolio, and then work with the local retailers to do product training and so on and so forth. So that's kind of the career path that I've had.
Pretty amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. And I hesitate to say this, but I've really had no agronomy training whatsoever from a college perspective. Didn't take any ag in high school. But I think like most of us, yes, college education is good. Don't get me wrong. I do like college education. I think everybody should have that if possible. But there is so much more that can be learned within the industry that you're in,
yeah,
especially ag. And it's really reaching out and being in tune with those that are leaders and influencers within the businesses and the organizations that you're with. And the more you can reach out to them and learn from them and study and be a student of the game, that's where we typically learn the most. And I will also say, through my retail days and even through the days we're here with Winfield United, the customers and learning from the customers is the most key. That's where you learn the most. And I don't care if it's in the position I'm in today, working with the local retailers and the sellers, and getting their input and feedback. But also anytime we get a chance to work with a grower, because at the end of the day, they're our customers, right? And yeah. they're our owners as well. Not only your owners, but they're our owners as being a cooperative system, as being Land O'Lakes. So they're the ones that at the end of the day, if we can't help them solve problems, then what are we really doing?
Yeah.
Right. They're the ones that they need the help. So at the end of the day, that's where I always revert back to. And that's where we go.
Well, so you come out of high school, you're mm-hmm. like, I don't want to be involved in ag. Mm-hmm. I want to go do something different, but you end up back in ag.
Right.
What do you think was the key thing that drew you back to that industry? And maybe at first it happened by mistake, but it obviously stuck. You stayed there. Have you ever thought about why?
It was probably the floaters weren't the best condition. I mean,
they weren't the old airflow that I used to drive. That was pretty rough riding.
Yeah,
it really was. It really was. and it's probably by mistake, Jeff, more than anything. The more I think about that though, a little bit, it might've been by mistake, but I would also say just what really probably brought me back was the people that I was able to work with within that organization, even at a young age, working through high school and college. I kind of saw the inner workings of how that organization worked and the people that were involved. And like I say, the influence, just talking with Dennis Montavon and several of the other managers within that organization, just really kind of brought me back to that and just really like the people. At the end of the day, if you're not enjoying the people that you work with or that you work for, it makes it tough. And thankfully, everybody along the way was pretty darn supportive.
Good.
Yeah, that's. I guess I asked that question because I think we've got something special in the ag industry. And I think it is the people, the mindset. It's that, you know, we've got a lot of, you know, farm kids that ended up in the industry. And so we've always got this common bond of agriculture. And I don't know, it's just something about the people that I think the corporate world, they miss that bond. And so I'm glad you gave that answer.
I think they do. And I'll kind of add on to that a little bit too. We all know from an ag perspective in the ag industry, we are a minority, a severe minority. We're a small percentage of the overall population of the people and the workforce as well. So our talent pool to be able to pull in is a lot smaller than what a lot of other industries are. So you really got to be focused on what you're doing. And it's really for the bigger cause. We realize in the ag business that we've got to feed the world. And that's a monumental task. We've got to help our growers through that process each and every day because it becomes more competitive and the demand for the food and in safety and security of all that food is becoming ever more present each and every day. So it's a integral working that we just got to make sure that, hey, we are a minority, but we are feeding the majority and we're here for the majority. And I think the majority of the population really don't understand what it takes from day one to get to the table.
No, not at all.
No. It'd be interesting to see if we could do some job switching, right? Or shadowing or something along that line where you pull somebody out of corporate America and whichever part of the world you want to and let them sit or tag along over a period of time. Maybe that's a week, 2 weeks, a month, whatever that might be, so that they would get to see really what happens and what it takes to get the job done. And vice versa maybe too, right?
Yeah. Well, Randy, tell us about cropland. What is cropland? I know when we type it out, it's autocorrect makes it cropland.
Correct.
But tell us about cropland.
Okay, so what cropland is, is...
No D.
No D, that's correct. We leave the D out. Cropland is the seed brand for ag retail, really is what it is. But it's the in-house brand for ag retail. And it was really 26 years ago, because last year was our 25th year as a cropland brand. It was brought on and developed so that our retailers have a defensible brand within their seed offerings. And we've got the majors out there. We've got the DeKalbs and the Pioneers and the Brevants and those types of things in NK. And But really, it's a defensible brand for that local retailer so that they can have something to help complement the other brands that they're selling. And the average grower across the U.S. is going to plant anywhere from 2.2, I think, to 2.7 brands each and every year. So if ag retail is only has one brand, sometimes they're going to miss out on that other opportunity that that grower has each and every year. So having that secondary brand, an in-house brand that they can call their own, is really the reason that we brought that cropland was brought on. And over the fruition of over the duration of 25 years, we've seen a lot of growth within the industry, and we've helped bolster a lot of seed on with the local retailers as well.
And it's unique that while a large multinational or national company, they try to have a product or seed product that will go across the entire country, and we've got product managers like you that are more selective for things for the Eastern Corn Belt if we're in Southern Indiana. I mean, so we're a little more nimble as far as what our product selection, right?
That is correct, Sal. That's correct. And like I said earlier, I'm one of seven on the cropland product management team that's led by Hector De Leon. And we are regional specific. So for me, where I sit in my geography, I cover really from the Boot Hill of Missouri across Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, and up into Michigan, and then as far to the east as corn is planted, really. And it is very specific by region or by area, because Southern Indiana, where we're sitting today, is a lot different than what Northern Illinois or even Northern Ohio might be. So it's really, I've got to be in tune with what the needs are for those respective regions, what the environment is, what the growing conditions are each and every year. A lot of different things are entailed in that, because not every one genetics will cover every growing scenario, every soil type, every management style, things like that. So it does become more regionalized and regional specific as we build out the portfolio to make sure that we have the best offerings for our local retailers.
Okay. Very good.
You know, with all the seed companies that, you know, are out there, you know, sometimes you probably feel like, hey, this marketplace gets really crowded. You know, everybody's got a brand of seed. What's as you meet with growers and you meet with sellers, even probably more importantly, meet with sellers, what's some of the biggest challenges they have on promoting that cropland brand?
Probably I think the biggest challenge is brand awareness. That's probably the biggest challenge. We as Winfield United, yes, we promote the cropland brand. We definitely do. But again, like I said earlier, it's the local retailer's in-house brand. So we really allow them to promote it how they see to promote it, how they want to promote it. Are all retailers good marketing companies? We're darn good at getting product on the ground. We're darn good working with growers. We may not be the best marketers out there in the world. So that's probably the biggest thing is brand awareness. Once we get through brand awareness, then growers will start to get familiar with it, understand the lingo behind it and why we do what we do and how we place products, how we select products, things like that, and how we manage them to get the largest ROI, then it becomes a lot easier. But the biggest thing in my mind has always been brand awareness.
So what goes into, so you actually select the seed that eventually that we sell at Premier Ag and other cooperatives or retailers will sell. So what all goes into the selection of that seed? I mean, you get to see behind the curtain, right? I mean, yes. So we see the finished product,
right?
But you get to see it before it ever is grown and bagged.
Correct.
So what do you look for?
What I look for, yield is always king, right? We're always going to look for yield. That's table stakes.
See, Jeff and I would stop right there. We'd be like, one wins. We want that one.
That's right. But it's
I want 10,000 units of it too.
10,000 units of that right out of the gate. We can do that.
Stack it high.
That's right. It's a long process really, Sal and Jeff. It is. And an in-depth process as well. So as we look at that, how do we select hybrids? How do we select genetics? It all starts with a needs assessment. So that needs assessment, usually we're going to start doing that process. Well, it's an all year process, but we'll get really down to the brass tacks, usually in that July, August timeframe, as we're getting ready for the next year, getting things been coming out. And to do that, I mean, I'll have my needs assessment. So I'll look at our current product lineup and then say, okay, this one's lacking in, I'm going to say, stock quality. This 114 day product, really good yielder, top end yielder, but maybe it doesn't have the stock quality or the roots or Southern rust or tar spot or whatever that may be. It's lacking there. So this is something that I want to look at and work with the genetic suppliers on selecting or finding a certain hybrid that has these key characteristics. So I'll do that as I look at, and my counterparts will, as we look at our current product portfolio. But we also try to gain as much feedback as we can from the local retail sellers and internal staff. So our sales staff and what they're looking at, and specifically locally, do they need a certain specific trait? Yes or no? Do they need it? What kind of agronomics do you need? This, that, and the other. So it all starts funnel up from the bottom. And I like to see as much input from the local retailer as well. What are their true needs? What do you need specifically in a certain hybrid and or variety of soybeans to make a difference and to really move the mark? And then from that process, we'll do that needs assessment. And then we'll start working with every genetic supplier to the industry. Anybody that supplies corn hybrids and or soybean varieties to the industry will work with those individuals or those companies and say, this is what we need. And through the fall, usually starting in, I'm going to say late July, August, September, October, we'll spend time with those and look at all the pre-commercial hybrids and varieties that are not on the market today. So maybe it's a new male-female cross, brand new hybrid that's available to the industry today, no commercial number. We'll start walking all those genetic material trials through the fall, and we'll start making our own notes on them and saying, okay, this kind of fits the bill on what we're looking for. This checks the box on this need that we have.
So in plots while they're growing.
Yes.
On the field.
Yep. That nobody even knows they're out there. I was shocked when I got into this role, Sal and Jeff, how many of those style of plots that the base genetic and germplasm suppliers have across the U.S. You don't know they're there. I didn't know they're there. You'll drive by them 100 times and never know they're there. You just got to get in. And once you're in there, and the amount of hybrids and varieties that are available today would blow your mind. We will look at several hundred.
Is that because of all the different combinations of?
Yes. Yep. All the different combinations that are available, different male, female crosses, different things like that. So there's a slug of them out there, and we'll just start wading through that in the fall. Then we'll start looking at yield data. How's it come back wise? And we'll dumb that process down. We'll narrow that overall availability of products down to about anywhere from, I'm guessing, around 100 or so corn hybrids. And each and every year we'll test a certain amount of those, probably about 80 experimentals altogether, and look at those and start saying, okay, then we'll bring them into our answer plot system and test them that way. And we'll look at them and say, okay, from a yield perspective, are they doing what we expect them to do? Yes or no? Or from an agronomic perspective, are they checking the boxes we need them to? If they do, we'll advance them into another year's worth of testing. If they don't, we kick them out and we'll start again the next year. So it's just an ever evolving process. And we're always looking a year, two, maybe 3 years ahead in advance, because normally we'll do 2 years worth of a testing on an experimental product before it ever gets commercialized. After we pick it.
Then you grow it for a couple of years.
Yes. Yes. We'll look at it and evaluate it locally. And how it performs. So just outside of town here, that's one of the locations where that I will walk multiple times throughout the year. And okay, if that specific experimental looks really, really good here, but as I get into maybe Illinois or Northern Indiana or over in Ohio, and this is the only place that looks good, it may not make it into the bag. But if it checks the boxes across all those, I think I've got 16 answer plots that I cover across my geography, and they're replicated anywhere from 2 to 3 times at each location. So I'll get a good look across the big geography. And if it checks the box there, more than likely it's probably going to get advanced into a bag.
Wow.
So I guess that was my next thought was, you know, what you've got to find something that works for that grower in mm-hmm. the Boot Hill, Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
That probably doesn't work in Michigan.
That's correct.
How do you add those complicated layers into what you're going to select?
It's a tough one.
Yeah.
It is. But you just got to realize, and we start looking at maturity ranges too, right? So what you're going to plant in the Boot Hill in Missouri is not going to be the same relative maturity as what you're going to plant up in Michigan. So we got to kind of be concise on how we're looking at that as well. But if I'm looking in Michigan and I'm going to say it's a 95 day product, I've also got to be in communication with my other product managers that cover that same relative maturity and how well does it blend across their geography. And then we'll start looking at it. So they all get scrutinized really, really hard because we can't, yes, we can be, we try to be as localized with hybrids as we can, but still at the same time, we've got to be able to make those hybrids work east to west as much as we possibly can.
Yeah. So with seed, it's, you're going to have a finite amount that you can get. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's not, hey, it's a chemical. We're just going to fire the plant up and make more.
Yep.
So how do you guys internally fight for your area? You've got one that, man, this thing's killer. I can take this to Michigan, but you also got Wisconsin and Minnesota. They want the same one. How do you guys fight that out?
That is a good question.
That's a very good question. I don't know if I should.
And how often do you win? Is there somebody better than you, Randy?
I'm not going to say that. We're all equal. I'll put it that way. Really what it becomes down to is, as we start building supply plans out within our business, it all does, a lot of it funnels back to local. Okay. So here at Premier and your local Winfield rep that works for you, or the cropland rep that works alongside with you, they'll go through a forecasting process, and we're going through that right now. We went through round one forecast. We're going through round two forecasts here, and we'll build.
This is for 26.
This is for 26. That's right. Yeah. So Dylan will be doing that and getting that back to me here by next Friday. And we'll start looking at those forecasts. So how good is a Dylan at forecasting what his needs are going to be in 26.
You just got called out, Dylan. I hope you're
listening.
Dylan, I hope
you're listening here. But I'm using Dylan as an example. Okay. We don't take that process lightly. Okay. We want to make sure that we are as close to what expected needs are for the local retailer, because in this case, Dylan is working on behalf of making sure that he's got the supply that he needs, that Premier needs to sell. And that goes across the country. That's the way we do that. So then whenever it becomes, we've got a certain product that really works east to west, and we start fighting east to west, we'll do the best we can to fill supply for everybody that we possibly can. Will we get that right 100% of the time? No. But it is about who can utilize the seed the best, and what's returns, things like that. There's a lot of things that work behind the scenes. But we have, that's the good thing is we have the ability to move things east to west, north to south, however we need to make sure that we are filling the supply where it was definitely needed the most.
Well, and we know salesmen are perfect at forecasting, and they never sandbag, and they never, you know, hey, I need 3,000 bags. I'm going to sell 1,000, but I'm going to order 3,000 bags.
Right. Just in case.
That's right. Just in case. It happens. I mean, I was on that side of the seat one time too, so I can't be lily white.
You knew how to game the system, right?
Yep. It happens, but at the end of the day, really, I think everybody, yes, you want to make sure that you get the product that you need for your customers, no doubt. But we're all realists as well. At some point in time, they're like, okay, we need to make sure we give this stuff up and somebody else gets what they need, because
make sure
it's going to happen. It's going to, next year, it might happen the other way around. Yep.
So Randy, you mentioned plots and then you said right outside of town here, the answer plots. So kind of explain what that network is and how important that is to a seed product manager in determining what to bring forward. What are you looking at, and what all is involved, I guess?
Okay. So at a respective answer plot, and there's give or take just shy of 100 answer plots across the United States. And like I say, I touch about 15 or 16 of them on a yearly basis, or I should say weekly or monthly or yearly basis for sure. And within those, we're not just testing for yield. Okay. There's more than just yield. Yeah. Yield's king. And that's what we're always looking at. But within that answer plot, we're going to start looking at what's that hybrid's response to nitrogen? How does it change, or how does nitrogen influence its overall production at the end of the day? Is this something that really requires nitrogen from a late season perspective to finish out and fill out the year? Or is it one that doesn't really utilize as much nitrogen late season? So we'll look at our response to nitrogen and see, and how do we manage that thing to make sure it really performs the way a grower wants to? Does it match the way the grower applies his nitrogen? If there's a hybrid out there that utilizes nitrogen late and finishes late to fill grain, and it does not have the nitrogen available, it's probably not going to perform the way that grower wants to. So if he is front loading 100% of his nitrogen at springtime, and we get some flushing rains or whatever, and we miss a little bit on nitrogen on the late season side, he's not going to be happy with that hybrid. So we've got to make sure that the grower is aware, and we need to make sure we, as the seed product management team, needs to make sure that the retail seller knows how to manage these based on nitrogen usage, and our internal staff as well. So it's really, everybody needs to know how to manage these respective hybrids And that's what we do with an answer plot. We'll look at a response to nitrogen. We'll drive that information out, and we provide that information not only on our cropland brand, but also our partner brands that we work with as well. Then we'll also look at a response to fungicide. So does every hybrid need a fungicide? Maybe, maybe not. What specific diseases are we targeting within that disease spectrum as well, so that we maximize the productivity of that hybrid and maximize ROI? So we're looking at a response to fungicide. So if a grower habitually does not use fungicide, or may use it, may not, I think it's imperative that the grower knows which hybrids, if he's only going to spray a certain amount of acres, it's imperative that he knows or she knows exactly which hybrid is going to provide the biggest response to biggest ROI on the dollars they spend for a fungicide. If they're blanket spraying 100% of their acres, then that's a little bit different story. But every answer plot, that's what we're always looking at. We're always looking at our true yield ability. We're looking at a response to nitrogen, and we're looking at a response to fungicide.
Can you elaborate a little? Because sometimes I think farmers, you know, look at, you know, a company like us, and they're like, yeah, they're just wanting another 15, 20, 25 bucks an acre out of me to go put a fungicide on. You know, but what I hear you saying is that, you know, there's all this research going in, mm-hmm. and you guys know what responds. And so it's not just a sales pitch. There's a reasoning behind why we're, you know, recommending that they use
that spray. Right.
So that's
right.
Can you help our farmers that are listening, help them understand, sure. you know, what you guys are doing behind the scenes?
Yeah. So behind the scenes, I mean, there's a lot of new genetics and germplasm that come to the industry, these new males and females that we've never seen before. And we're starting to see some things change too. Ear types have changed a little bit here over the last several years as well. We're seeing a lot more girthy type ears anymore that are coming into the industry. When I say girth, it's something that's from a kernel depth. Depth as being influenced big time. So how do we drive yield? What's components of yield? It's ears per acre and kernels per ear. That's typically how it's been, right? Now, another third big component of this is depth. And you think about that, it's no different than you and I each and every day. So we've got to make sure that kernel is filled to the nth degree to make sure we get the maximum amount of yield as we possibly can. You and I, as we feed ourselves, continue to feed ourselves, if we are shorting ourselves every day, we're going to lose weight. We're not going to be probably as energetic.
That's not been a problem for me and Sal. So, you know, we've done okay in that
department. If you were to go, we got in this area.
Yeah, if you were to go down that path. But I'm just trying to relate that back to a corn hybrid. You do not want a corn hybrid or a soybean variety, but a corn hybrid specifically, you don't want it to have a bad day. Mother Nature is always going to be in charge of what happens at the end of the day. True. But if we can make sure it doesn't have a bad day, we need to make sure that we know how to manage the nitrogen. We know how to manage the fungicide. So that's not the limiting factor as we go forth. Again, Mother Nature is going to dictate everything. But again, the fungicide piece of this, I think, is critical today too. If we can keep that plant healthy, alive until the very last day, and we allow that plant to go through natural senescence, where it just gives everything it possibly can, and as healthy and as alive as it possibly can till the last day, that's our best chance of making sure we're maximizing yield. And fungicide's a big component of that. Even the absence of disease, we see a pretty good response across the board on most every hybrid when there's no disease present, because we're allowing that hybrid to get to the final last day that's possibly can live, and filling the kernel to the tip, and that's where we're maximizing yield at the end of the day.
That's pretty interesting that when you're buying cropland, you're not just buying the seed and the genetics, but you're under trait, but you're also buying the management practice. So
that's right.
So you all have vetted out and tested and evaluated the management practice for that variety.
Correct.
That's pretty unique in the industry, I would say.
Yep, it is. And I've always thought this too, back when I was selling seed in my retail days, and even when I'm with Winfield, it's not what is on the bag. It's not the brand that's on the bag. It's what's in the bag. Yeah, there's seed in the bag, but what else are you buying within that bag? And you hit it, Sal. It's the information and the insights that can be given when that grower purchases that seed. How can we make this thing the most profitable for your given acre each and every year? And it's just not say, here's XYZ hybrid planted at 34,000 and we'll see you tomorrow. That doesn't work. There is the yield potential of these hybrids today is higher than it's ever been, we've ever seen in our life. And I'd hate to see what it's going to look like 20 years from now. Well, I'd like to see, but how but are we going
to... decided to go back to 1804.
But I went to 1804. Yeah. That's right. That's right.
We're building fertilizer plants that thinks it's going to be a lot bigger yield.
It's going to be. So it's going to become more critical to how we manage these hybrids. It's going to continue to change and continue to evolve. But we got to get the basics right. And that's, again, back where you're buying more than just a bag of seed. It's what's the insights that come along with that, and how can we manage these the best each and every year.
All right.
Yeah, that's – I used to work for a chemical company back in my early days. So I went through the 90s, and I was with Monsanto. We were introducing Roundup Ready. So I worked a lot with the seed sellers. It was the – you know, the Asgrow soybeans and the Cropland soybeans. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would be at all these plots. And one of the things I used to hear back then from some of those Cropland guys, and it was a great one. Dave Bombay was, mm-hmm. he was just a great mentor and teaching me about the seed side of the business. And I would listen to those plots, and they were talking about bringing in Western hybrids for drought resistance. Mm-hmm. Well, now you flash forward 30 years later, and you know, I'm watching my neighbors in Washington, Indiana, where I'm from. It didn't rain last summer. I mean, we were short moisture. Mm-hmm. And I'm seeing guys take off 280, 300 bushel corn. And I'm like, what would it have done if it actually rained?
Yeah. Right.
And so can you talk about, I mean, these hybrids are, they're phenomenal and pouring out yield when Mother Nature doesn't cooperate, you know. I know you guys have done that over time, but can you speak to the what we're getting along with drought resistance?
And it is. I mean, we go back to that, and I remember those same conversations, the Westerns, the Easterns, Northerns, this, that, and the other high-yield females. That's kind of became, and I'll use a term that a coworker told me several years ago, it's really become a mutt factor within the base genetics of corn hybrids today. When I say a mutt factor, there's just so many different combinations that these seed companies, these germplasm companies can work with today and plug and play through molecular breeding and give tremendous combinations of hybrids today that we've never seen in the past. And if it is truly drought, they're able to select certain things out of there and say, okay, this is a very drought resistant hybrid, very heat tolerant hybrid. Maybe it's very good on southern rust. Maybe it is very good on tar spot, this, that, and the other. And they can plug and play so fast today like we've never had in the past. And it's just the speed of way this thing churns versus what we did, I'm going to say 15, 20 years ago. And that's where we're starting to see the benefit of that, where 20 years ago, if we experienced that same drought 20 years ago as what we did today, you would have not seen 200 bushel corn.
No. Yeah, we talk about 2012.
We talk about 2012, and I experienced it in parts of Ohio this year. I would say that was very close to what we saw in 2012 in central Illinois. And you did not see those 20 and 30 bushel yield levels. There was a few out there, but that yield level is definitely up. So, and it goes back to, I guess, as well, is how do we continue to feed the world as a growing population continues to grow? We've got to feed more and more mouths across the world. And it's through the small things and the things that they're doing from the genetics supply standpoint, the genetics and the breeding of that, and the combinations they can turn so fast and select for certain things to help bring that bottom yield level up.
And the last question I've got for you, I'm going to kind of put you on the hot seat here.
Oh,
I'm a farmer. I've been using this hybrid for 2 years. This has been my number one yielder.
Yep.
So I'm going into year three and I say, hey, you know, I want a couple hundred bags of that. Yeah, we don't offer that anymore. How do you get through that?
We go through that. It's a tough one. It is, Jeff. The way we get through that, and it's through the process that we work through. And it goes back to genetic rate of gain. The USDA states that genetic rate of gain, I think, is about 2 bushel per year. So every hybrid that's brought to the industry by every seed company, we're seeing about a 2 bushel yield incremental gain each and every year on new hybrids that are brought to the industry. Now, that says that there's some that are probably 3 or 4, and there's some that are probably 0 or -1, right? So that the average is going to still be around 2 bushel. Internally within the Cropland side, we look at the same thing within our brand. So as these new experimentals and new hybrids are brought on, we'll compare those to the previous year's class releases. So if I look and I think the numbers are what we released in 2025, so back here in November, there was 8 hybrids that we released to the cropland bag. If we compare those to the products that we just released a year ago in 2024, there's a 4.3 bushel yield advantage.
Wow.
If we look at 2023 class, I think it was like 4.5. If we look at 2022 class, which is where you're at, that 3-year-old hybrid, I think it's right at 7 bushel. So I don't disagree. That hybrid that you just fell in love with and really want 100 bags of, are you willing to sacrifice 7 bushel potential on your farm? My guess is probably not. So it becomes a sticky situation, but as long as we're agronomically, that hybrid is fairly similar. Maybe the trait package is similar as well. We haven't even touched on traits yet. It's really a genetic rate of gain, and we've got the information, the data, and the insights behind that based off of all our testing and the answer plots that we can back that information up. The question was asked to me at a meeting here a while back, an internal meeting. So there's a certain hybrid, Randy, that is a brand new hybrid. How many times has that thing been tested? How many data points do we have on that specific hybrid being released for year one? I was like, well, this year's worth of testing, we've probably got about 2,700 data points on that one hybrid. God. Yield, response to nitrogen, response to fungicide, that type of stuff. But within the answer plot, again, that's where the data becomes important for us, is how repeatable is that data? And out of those, give or take 90-some to 100 answer plots, we'll generate about several million, like 6 million data points within those answer plots, and drive our LSDs down so we can say, all right, this is repeatable. This is something that we can predict as well. So again, back, that's a long answer to your short question, but the data tells us it's going to be better.
That's pretty neat, though, that once you decide to actually put it in a bag, it's pretty good seed.
Yes.
And then it goes back to that management practice that and the insights that go with it.
That's right.
Well, we may have to get to the traits the next time, because this has been a good, I think I've learned a little bit. I always learn more when I come in here, but this has been a very informative one, Randy.
Well, I hope so. It's always been a pleasure. I mean, it's a pleasure working with Premier and every retailer out there across the United States. But again, it's the day-to-day conversations that we can have sitting across the table, not only with the retailers, but all the way down to the grower level. It's always good.
All right. Jeff, anything else?
No, I think it's been interesting to kind of, you know, see behind the curtain and all the stuff that goes into it, not just, hey, we're just throwing corn in a bag and this is one you need to plant. So,
right. There's a lot of work that goes behind the scenes.
Yep. Sure, yeah. Very interesting.
All right. Well, thanks, Randy.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Another episode of The High Ground, powered by Premier Companies. Thank you all very much. And please like and subscribe.